It's Thursday, November 17th, 2011, and you're listening to episode 251 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 50 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Pat.
My name is Chad.
My name is John.
Two announcements real quick, and then we will get down to it. First off, I want to remind everyone that our Star Wars Old Republic Guild is out there, House Nakash. If you are interested in joining that, we are going to be playing PvE Sith side. I'll put a link in the show notes. Yeah, whatever. Put a link in the show.
Oh,
at least
no.
It's Sith.
Not danger in my MMO.
Oh, no, an MMO.
I'll kill you all.
I'm right there.
Link Sith. In the show notes.
Oh, I'm all about the Sith. That wasn't the fart part. Dan knows what the fart was about.
I know what the fart part is.
John's upset that we're not going to be griefing other people. Server. Yeah.
Counter-griefing. Marginally afraid that when you leave the town walls, something slightly bad could happen to you. It just adds that
by which you
spice.
Mean getting consistently camped by three guys max level.
No,
when you're
you get camped
10,
one time, right? Then you call in the cavalry and camp them.
What cavalry?
Yeah, what cavalry?
Us. Our faithful listeners who are listening right now and saying, yes, John, if you said in guild that we had to go to the barons and kill a level 30 alliance, I would go with you.
I will say this, the guild is at 49 members as of today, so
yeah, we're doing really well.
Yeah,
and that's not 49
game hasn't even started and we have 40, almost 50 members.
Yeah, remember, that's not characters, that's accounts.
That's true. Yeah, once all everybody gets in their alts, we'll have, I would assume we'll have at least approaching 150 people.
Yeah, I'm still waiting on GameStop to give me my free key thing. I don't know what the hell possessed me to go do this GameStop, but
well, we also have
an
adversary guild, which is also run by a guy who listens to Fear the Boot, Foundation of Jantor.
Foundation of Jantor.
And that is where we are going to put our Republic alts, and in return, they're going to put their Sith alts in our guild. So even at start, we actually have more than 49 accounts.
And in
the
return
guild.
For that, I will gesture at them menacingly, mm-hmm. as I can neither speak to them nor attack them. In
actually,
world.
At this point, the only thing that we don't have is we don't have an ally guild. Actually, one of the members that had joined posted in our forum on the House Nakash site, which is a Star Wars site, that he said we ought to try to find a Sith ally guild, and that's just something I haven't really.
If by ally
yet.
You mean conscript / slave farm, that's fine with me.
And well, that's
if
what
by
I was
ally
thinking.
You mean.
I thought, you know, if we
peer
can find
organization,
if I can find a guild that is exclusively Twi'lek female,
yes.
Then yes, they will be my right. ally guild.
So Pat, failing to find your whorehouse. There is another guild that is also adversaries with Foundation of Jantor. It's on the Sith side.
That's true.
We could ally with them.
That's true.
The point being, with Old Republic coming out, if you're interested in playing the game and do not yet have a guild home, be sure to check the show notes for a link to that, because we've got a guild going over there that I'm really looking forward to running with. The second thing, he's not on here himself to promote this because apparently he's like humping a rock or something. Is I want to remind you guys that Chris is writing Skies of Glass serial fiction at skiesofglass.com. I'll put a link in the show notes in case you can't remember skiesofglass.com. But hey, what the hell? Who am I to judge? There will be a link in the show notes if you want to check out his serial fiction. The thing about
he has a very nice GeoCities page that it redirects to. The thing AOL about, hometown.
The thing about him humping a rock was he was apparently tonight he's busy like watching the desk at the gym he works
gym.
At. And, of course, Chris being Chris, he can't just say this. He has to do it in pointless pictures. And the picture he put up is
this guy lifting a medicine ball.
Yeah, a guy lifting a medicine
ball. I don't think they're medicine balls.
Yeah,
that's literally
a rock.
They're
rocks.
Like boulders that have been milled into, you know, perfect spherical shape.
Like medicine ball shapes.
These things are, they're about at least 2 feet across. Looks like solid granite. I mean, the things must weigh 300 or 400 pounds. And there's this one guy, this muscle-bound guy. He's picking it up as best he can, but the way he's holding it is he's basically got a brace against his lower torso and his crotch.
What you're saying,
so it literally looks like he's having sex with it.
So what you're saying, this guy and the rock are married in Arkansas?
Yes, absolutely.
Excellent.
No, we're saying Chris and that rock are married in Iowa.
Yeah.
So, Pat, I'm going to give you a free turn at bat, and here's why. Next episode, we're going to have Beth on to talk about romance in games. And I'm not going to spoil that within a pre-conversation about what exactly it is we're going to talk about.
Or what exactly Beth and I do in our past notes roleplay.
I encourage her, by the way.
Oh, I know. You are trying to get me in character laid with your wife, and
oh,
I really appreciate it.
But what I do want to do is I know she's going to say some terrible things about you.
That's true.
Because you embarrassed her at our last game sitting. So I want to give you a chance to prophylactically attack her or defend yourself about anything you think she might say.
Boy, you know, you are so lucky Beth doesn't listen to this show.
She has, but she hasn't been able to lately for whatever reason, but she used to. I don't know. I implore her to just do whatever she wants. I'm sure she's going to say shit that's going to be bad and that's going to be embarrassing to me and whatever, but I just really don't care. That's fine. You know what? They're going to love it, and they're going to say, needs more Beth, and we're going to go from there. And
next episode
awesome.
Is shaping up to be the first majority female Fear the Boot episode in the history
yeah,
of the
Yeah, I hope
podcast.
It pulls off.
Well, really not do. Counting the ladies' episodes.
Well, yeah, I mean, real episode.
Wow.
Well, it was a bonus episode. Wasn't the ladies one a bonus?
No,
it
was a regular. It was a numbered episode. No, it was a numbered show.
So there's no telling, but Beth is the talker. Good Lord. As little as I talk, Beth talks all the time. We're a perfect balance for one another. I don't talk much. She talks too much. So we meet in the middle. It's a zen kind of a thing. You're in for a treat.
Are you saying your wife talks too much?
I'm saying she's a woman.
That's not helping your case at all.
John, you want to give us an update on Blood Moon Goblins and then we're going
to... No, actually, I wanted to hear Pat's thoughts on women in the vote.
On the suffrage movement?
Well, yeah. I'm not going to say that the depression starting immediately was causation or correlation, but... Blood Moon Goblins is churning along great. We have done the cartography, a lot of the character art. I have designed most of the NPCs and all of the Warrens. Since the closing of the Kickstarter and the start in earnest of production, we are in the neighborhood of halfway finished. I don't think I'm going to meet my goal of a November-December 2011 release date, but I'm not that far behind. It is interesting to work with another creative, or two other creatives in this case. Ruben, Save vs. DM, has done a layout template and will actually fit the final manuscript into its final form. Of course, Keith Curtis is doing the artwork. But having discussions with them about the visual presentation aspects and hashing out what is kind of a vision that is neither of ours but both of ours in the end is really cool.
That's something I wanted to ask you about. What have you learned during this process? What surprised you? What's maybe not quite surprised you, but wasn't exactly how you expected?
The biggest conflict I have in my own head when I'm writing is, am I over or under writing this? Have I explained this 10 times already? Or is this only coherent because I have my own notes in the back of my own head and I'm missing things and I need to say more? It's a difficult design decision because I'm not really telling a story. I am giving someone an instruction manual about how to tell a certain type of story help of PCs who will take
it. But on the other hand, you don't want to make it instructions that are procedural. Step one, step two, step three.
No, yeah, I want to avoid both. This is what happens on minute number five. This is what happens on day two, because that's stupid. That's not a game.
See, that's what happened with me. I wrote Inception. And Inception, while when you play it, it is a role-playing game, what I wrote is not really a role-playing game. It's an essay.
Yeah.
And when I did Silent Memories, people were like, hey, you got to write this up. You got to write this up. And when I went to write it up, I'm like, well, I just don't want to do an essay. I don't want to do a game. You know, nothing huge, artwork, Kickstarters, all that sort of stuff. But I wanted to get something with a little bit more format. And I had some ideas that I wanted to flesh out in it. And I sat down, and for me, it was turned out one of two ways. I mean, it was like a procedural instruction, something that like a technical document I'd write at work, or it was another essay. That's why I never wrote it. I never got around to writing it. I couldn't get that creative wind in my sails to get out what I wanted out of it.
I've got plenty of creative wind in my sails, but as well as avoiding the step-by-step instruction manual, I'm also trying to avoid making it too open-ended.
Right.
Rule zero, yes, great. And there is a lot of room for modularity. In fact, it needs to be modular. If you want to insert your goblin group template as a social force and political pillar of the society, you have to take out one of the out-of-box ones, because as in the box, it's a perfectly functioning society with no room for any new PCs. Mm-hmm. But it's real easy to write a forward that's like, set a campaign in a goblin world. You make up the rest.
Right.
I want to give people way more for their money than
People are not paying you so that they can make up the rest.
Right, right. Yeah. The two takeaway lessons are the collaborative process
where you involve multiple people to create one thing is cool and very different than making one thing up all by yourself. And game design, as I have experienced it so far, is a tight act between giving ample instructions to illustrate how to run this world and what conflicts and adventures to put in there, and not overdoing it or underdoing it.
Mm-hmm. There's something that I found in working on Apocrisis with Keith. And while right now we're talking about game design, I think really this is something that in many ways applies to game masters. Because really, if you think about it, even if you're not designing the setting, you are still designing a game. You're designing the events and the places and whatever that surround the group of characters that
and
you're
dealing with. And I should maybe amend my own statement. Setting design. We're talking about setting design. Yeah. I'm not designing a game. I'm running Pathfinder.
Yeah.
Characters and places.
As strange as it sounds to say, there are parts of the setting that I think Keith understands better than I do. There are things that he latches on to. There are things that he fleshes out. There are things where he puts a creative spin on something I hadn't thought about. And I look, I'm like, you know, that actually makes perfect sense.
We've done that.
He'll extrapolate, interpolate, read out of, read into, whatever. All this stuff. And I think this applies, once again, not just to game design, but to game mastering. Because this goes back to the whole thing of when your players latch onto something, pay attention. Because there may be something in your story, in just the game you are running for your weekly group, that they get better than you do.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
they have realized is more interesting than you gave it credit for.
That's the beauty of brainstorming. I mean, you know, we learned this concept long ago as sort of as a child. And it really just, it rings true in every aspect of the fact that you have an idea, but there's no idea that you singly have that cannot be made better by throwing it out to a group of two or three people and letting it, you know, be built upon. Yeah. You know, you can flesh it out better and you can think of things that you never would have, because, you know, people tend to think linearly. They sort of get an idea and they're just sort of kind of laser focused in that aspect, and they can't think from right or left field. And that's what other people bring to it. So,
yeah, and it certainly is a balancing act, because on the one hand, as the creator, there is a unified creative vision that gets lost when too many cooks get in the kitchen. And I think if we look through well-known intellectual properties, we all have our favorite axe to grind where it was great until some guy got a hold of it and started screwing with it. But
yes. Frevin Frimbietta.
But on the flip side, well, I was actually going to use him on the other side. If you cut everyone else out of the creative process, you end up in absolute stagnation. Mm-hmm. You end up
Frevin Frimbietta.
Yeah. You end up with something that is
going on the Power 16.
You end up with something that's as myopic as every human being is. I mean, it's just the inevitability.
And the most beautiful thing is that when your co-creator can make something new out of nothing but the parts that came out of your own vision and were put on the table. The best moment of creative synergy I've had so far with Keith is when we were trying to find something to do with the water pool in the Warrens. I don't know if you remember it even being in the setting, Dan, but there was a pool down at the lowest level of the Warrens that I never did anything with. It was just kind of there on the map that I ripped out the internet, and I said, yeah, whatever. And Keith said, well, what if it was this elaborate sieve system that the dwarves who owned the place at the beginning left behind? There's nothing there. There's no label on it. But if you get to the source of the water, it's just this perfectly cylindrical tube. And you don't tell your players anything more than that. This is not natural. This is hewn into the mountain.
Yeah.
But why?
And they would have to figure out, or not, the goblins would never be able to
exactly.
make this.
And it's not obvious. It's not sitting there right there. It's down and back. And I have not written a goblin alive out of the box that knows it's there or why it's there. Mm. But a player could find out without too much trouble.
I have several topics that I want to get into today. But before we do, Chad, there was something that you want to talk about that kind of ties into what we talked about. I don't remember, it was last episode or two ago, or whenever it was, we were talking about bridge games. Mm-hmm. And this is shopping.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Well, you know, we were kind of talking about this at dinner. The concept of in-game shopping, it does not necessarily mean in-character shopping, but it's that thing where you get to the town, or you get to the space station, or you get to the whatever, and the characters have money in their pockets, and there is stuff to buy, and that it's listed in the player's handbooks and in the game systems. Or even if it's not, it's there reasonably, and the game master could come up with, you know, monetary values for things.
Or they're indexed in a list.
Yes.
In the most boring fashion possible.
Right. And I both love shopping and I hate shopping. I love shopping because, you know, while it's fun to get new stuff for even in an imaginary game,
BattleTech is real.
There is aspects of role-playing that are within shopping. Instead of just saying, oh, well, here's your itemized list with your gold piece costs, check off what you want. You know, you could say, well, there's the shopkeeper and he's the fat, boisterous guy. And, you know, you can even run little subplots and you can do RP stuff and that sort of thing.
Who knows that every shopkeeper in fantasy is either fat, old, or maybe hot.
I had the hat store in the game that I ran that Wayne went into was a 45-year-old-ish woman who was neither fat nor hot. So there, ass.
Well, yeah, that's why I never went to that store.
I was just making an observation about, look, it's
no,
like,
I agree. That's why Wayne went into that store, because there was no threatening, interesting thing in there.
Yeah. Something that might upstage his character.
Something that might happen. That would just be unacceptable.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, is that...
Something useful.
Yes.
When you go into these situations, and like I said, I even hesitate to say... You know, shopping is X. Because I think that's one of the things we do here on Fear the Boot, too, is when we talk about a topic, we define it. This is like, okay, this is what we are talking about. Now we're going to talk about it off that base. But this concept, this very simple, nondescript concept in role-playing games of shopping, it is a thing that is in many, many people's role-playing games, yet it is very different from role-playing game to role-playing game. Sometimes shopping is just that meta, out-of-character thing that occurs during bridge games or out-of-games, where you say, hey, we have some downtime, we're in this town, can my character pick up some stuff? And the game master's like, yeah, sure. Then you open up your player's handbook and you deduct your coins or your credits or your money or your moo-moos or whatever.
Damn Tarians.
And you write down the stuff.
That engine shell had cost me like 9 trillion moo-moos.
But on the other hand, you can also...
A McGriddle costs like 9 trillion moo-moos.
Yeah, well, engine shells are cheap.
In Battletech, that's way beyond the technology level,
it's,
please.
It's unholy to eat a McGriddle in Tarian space because there's beef on it.
So what do you guys do with shopping and this shopping
content? I don't.
Let me start by saying that I think the worst kind of shopping... is just that. It's shopping.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm in a game and somebody says to me, you know what? After that last mission, I realized that, man, we could really use a tracking beacon. Or I really realized, man, every game master makes their holes 60 feet deep instead of 50 feet of rope. I need 100 feet of rope or whatever.
Man, I really wish Wayne would face the light mech that's pursuing him when he uses his jump jets. I'm sorry, that was just my observation.
We're
my
not starting the locust thing again.
Oh my god.
A plague of locusts.
I even told him, I said, Wayne, you jumped. You realize when you land after a jump, you can face any direction you want to.
Including the one that makes it 4 hexes longer to get behind you.
No.
That I can do.
Gyro hit, rear center torso, fall down.
Because the person comes in and says, you know, hey, I just want this. You say, okay, fine. Look up the price in the player's book, whatever. Take it off. We're moving on.
Right.
Once in a rare while, it's also interesting if somebody wants something that they're trying to turn into a role-playing situation. Wayne's search for a hat.
Yes, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, this was not a search for any particular hat. The hat costs whatever. It costs a silver piece. Who gives a crap?
Right.
But
Wayne gives a crap.
He was looking for the hat that fit his personal idiom.
Not the magical hat of mind control of Margoth that is in the bottom of the deepest dungeon.
He's looking for a hat.
A useless, mundane, valueless hat to reflect his useless, mundane, valueless character.
Wow!
But may cost a whole lot more.
So you don't like bards, I take it.
Not really.
Wayne did play you.
I wish Wayne was here, because I really hated that bard. I wanted to be able to defend himself and talk back. But I'm gonna keep going anyway.
We were playing, John and I were playing through Marvel Ultimate Alliance 2, and I don't even remember who it was, but some really dumb... This is not even a B-lister. This is like a W-lister Marvel hero pops up. And John's like, this character's completely stupid. It's like something Wayne would come up with.
Wow. I like Wayne's characters.
Do you like that bard?
Yeah.
I'm going to hit him with a frying pan. Get out.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, John.
Sing your dumb song that wastes your turn and gives everyone else a +1 to their will save. Get on with it so I can take control of my sorcerer and web everything.
Like I said, there's really only one way to play a bard, and that is to play a rogue mage.
Yeah.
Yeah. That basically says they're a bard.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. When Wayne said, I'm going to buy that hat, it was an opportunity for role playing. Mm-hmm. We got to.
You know what that is, John? It's role playing.
Yeah.
We got to have this NPC shopkeeper that Chad came up with. We got to have some of us jumped in as NPCs as well, and mm-hmm. some of us as PCs were antagonizing and whatever. And the point is, yeah. we were able to do something with that.
Some of us were studying furiously for the bar exam and thinking, thank God I'm not shopping for a hat in D&D.
But what I freaking hate is a reverse situation.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have a purchase in mind. You just have money burning a hole in your pocket.
Yeah.
You walk into town, you just kill the dragon, you've got 10,000 gold pieces. How do you want to spend it? I don't know. Pass me the DMG and let me see what I can afford.
Mm-hmm.
This leads to two issues. Number one, boring.
Yes.
Because this shuts down the game while everyone pages through the books, compares. Because
you always have five people in two books.
Exactly. Or five people in one book.
Yeah.
And you have someone there on their phone looking up the Tome of Butt Green level 9 edition, where there's this special extra skill and this sword that is totally cool. Will you let it in, Dan? Thanks.
And then on top of that, it's completely freaking out of character. It's like, well, we're in this D&D town. I'm going to go to the magical weapon shop. Really? They just churn those out? You're going to go get some magic?
Some genres of fantasy
I know, and
do.
Some settings.
None that I run. In, but
if you want to give the muggles their faintest, slightest, dimmest hope of keeping up with the magics, you pretty much have to give them the Vorpal Sword Emporium. I'm still not going to do it because it's stupid.
Did you get to both your points yet?
Yeah, those were good.
I have shit to say. So on the topic of shopping, I have to actually give one of my previous DMs credit where credit is due, because I think he handled it very well. Same situation that you're sort of talking about. We've got a campaign. This is a high fantasy campaign. It was high magic. And we did have the money. And what he came up with, his idea that he actually did, and we had a lot of fun with this, was that once a year, there was what I would basically call the black market of magical weapon and item emporium that would happen, and it was in the Underdark. I mean, let's say what it is. It was in the Underdark area, but it was known by the the high magical people that this existed. Most of the people in the world did not know about it. Adventurers could find out, because obviously adventurers, like we've talked about in previous episodes, especially on the forum lately, are sort of demigod level characters. They are powerful. So they can find out about this kind of thing.
A very rare market.
And exactly. This was a once a year thing, and it was every year. You would travel to the Underdark. So this is what it turned into be, is the GM prepared this adventure. And what it was is, you've got to get there. First of all, you've got to go through the Underdark, which, if anyone has ever experienced the Underdark in its classic setting, it's a very dangerous place.
Yes.
So getting there in and of itself is an adventure. You've set up an adventure for them to do. Then you get there, and then the thing is, it's not, okay, now we're here, now I flipped through the DMG, and here's what I want. No, that's not it. He prepared it. There were four or five different vendors, and it was all, like, there was a dark elf, or, you know, the drow. It's drow, goddammit.
Drow.
They had, there was, like, the drow. Goblins, there was, I forget what all
You're
they
all
were,
wrong.
But there were the dark dwarves. 10,000
Scotsmen.
There were four, there were at least four separate factions that basically were represented here, and they had... They brought things to
Drow,
sell.
Drow, Durgar, yeah, Phosphorus, Drow, Durgar, and Fungus, and...
Yeah, like I said, I can't remember
spiders.
Who all. But anyway, so yeah, so...
Lots of
and
spiders.
The GM
Sexy
had prepared this.
They're called Driders.
That's right. He had already planned out each of these four people. This is what they have to offer you guys. And we as a party, and as part of the role-playing, you go around and see it to each shop and say, they'd show you, well, this is what we've got. This is what I have prepared to sell to you, and this is what it costs. Yes, it was still a shopping trip, but it was couched in an adventure. It was something that was planned, and it wasn't just simply the flipping through the book, spending money that you had, you know, was burning a hole in your pocket. And the nice thing about it was, too, is playing it true to form, going to the Underdark, gold pieces are not really the currency of choice.
Babies are.
Well, no, for them, it's like the things that are valuable to people that live... In the Moomers. Away from the light of the sun,
crap, you
like
can grow
wood.
Yeah,
we took a cart full of wood down there to buy with and stuff like that. And salt.
I've got wood for magic items. Yeah,
that's right. The deep gnomes. The deep gnomes. They were salt miners. So, you take this sort of mundane from the surface world down there that was valuable down there because they don't have it.
Settlers of Catan.
Yeah. So, you know, like I said, credit where credit's due. I thought it was great. We had a lot of fun with it. And that obviously, it was about a once a year kind of a thing. And this thing, we did not do this kind of shopping on the surface in the town that we were in.
Tell me you would not play Settlers of Catan under Dark Edition.
I would play Settlers of Catan under Dark Edition.
Totally play that.
All right.
As well.
But this is just one idea. And I think that's an idea. I think that's a good way to make it interesting for your players and also to make it interesting for you as the GM, for God's sake, because you're in control of it. You're putting it together. It's not just the player saying, okay, I want my Vorpal Sword plus 18.
Yep.
I have the money. You've got to give it to me.
There are two things that you've dealt with there. One is balancing the level of role play.
Oh my God, the thief wouldn't be a thief. It'd be the adventuring party because you're playing the Underdark edition. So you're the Underdark drow. And you're doing all the trading for all the
Settlers
and
of
then
okay.
Settlers of Underdark.
Oh, you're going I thought you meant like the thief class.
That's no. The thief, the
penguin thing, the little black
would
the little pawn that no one has any offensive names for.
Yes, totally. That's the adventuring party. And they go to that section of the Underdark, that hex of the Underdark.
And it stops producing resources.
It stops producing stuff because they're like killing and looting things. Yeah,
that's true.
Well, yeah. All right, so here's the thing. First off, is the first question you have to ask is how in-character versus out-of-character do you want it to be? When somebody says, I want to buy a clearly RP item, you can make an RP scene out of it. When somebody says, look, I just want a rope, I think giving personality and name it over to the shopkeeper is probably, depending on the taste of your groups, probably a pointless distraction. Just tell them how much it costs and get off the damn game.
But I don't think we're talking about buying another pint of lantern oil.
Right.
I think
it's
the second thing.
Magic sword.
Well,
second
thing depends. I mean, it's like in the bridge game episode, we talked about how there are ups and downs and ebbs and flows. I think that if you're on one of these ups and suddenly you go, time out, fat shopkeeper guy, because you need rope. Ho, ho, ho. And everyone's like, no,
ho,
no.
Ho, ho, who needs a rope? Ho, ho, ho.
Big Larry's rope. So, ho, ho, get some rope. Yeah, that's going to really kind of kill your tension that you're building. But if you're on a down thing and they're into it.
Well, and the second thing I was going to say that Pat dealt with here is availability.
Big Larry's rope.
Because one of the things that always got me, and especially some of our early D&D games, you go into town and the town is arranged purely for the needs of an adventurer. There's a weapons shop. There's an armor shop. Never mind that leather tanning and woodworking and metalworking have nothing in common with one another. There ought to be a blacksmith and a woodworker and a tanner and all this other stuff. Oh no, there was a weapons shop. There was an armor shop. There was a magical item shop. When we got more mature as role players, they became antiquity and curiosity shops.
Yeah.
It was crap. And I don't know, maybe once again, maybe for a certain setting.
Well, there's genre specific.
Yeah, maybe for certain settings it works. But the thing was, it didn't deal with availabilities. For example, in Shadowrun, there's action availability attached to items. When you're creating your character, you can typically get about whatever the GM will allow. Once you're in the game, you need certain contacts, and those contacts roll certain skills against certain difficulties. It's like, okay, you have the money to buy a panther cannon. That's cute. I can't get one.
Right.
Does it fire actual panthers?
Yes, it does. The cougar cannon is far more interesting.
Oh, that's what John might have. That was actually my nickname.
Woohoo! But the
that's my penis.
The cougar
nickname.
Cannon?
No, I just made that up.
But oh, okay.
I was running with Pat.
That makes the story significantly less interesting, though.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
BattleTech has similar rules. In D&D, I'm sure there are rules out there in some books somewhere. They're not in the core books, at least not that I've seen.
There is a rule out there somewhere,
for
something.
Everything.
For, yes.
It's like rule 34 or whatever, except it's D&D rules. Whatever you can
actually,
think of.
Actually, there's quite a bit of D&D rule 34.
There's a D&D rule for that. And
Delcenera.
Then Vivi probably knows it. But it really comes down to what the Game Master wants to be available.
Yep.
And it's one of those things of like, I go into a town, what do I find? Really, asshole?
Yeah.
You want me to make this up on the spot out of this stack of books? Or I go into town, do they have this? Okay, well, at least you've given me a starting point, but now I got to balance that against what you have and what you ought to have and where I want to go with this. And, well, if they have that, will they have the 10 other things everybody else wants? And so, Pat, that approach you named is one way of doing it, especially with rare items.
Yeah.
Larry always has ropes, but if you want, like, we'll say wondrous items, mm-hmm. here is a list of what they have.
And that's just exactly that, it, because, yeah, it, and the nice thing is in the way I've described, the GM had full control of this. The players didn't go into these four shopkeepers and say, okay, yeah, those things that you've got are nice, but here's what I want. And they're like, yeah, this is all we've got. Yeah. Sorry, you don't want it. It's pretty cool
because you could dig all the way down there only to find out they don't even have what you wanted.
That's true. Yep. And there were times there, I remember, we would all go down there taking whatever money, items with us, you know, that were valuable to buy. And that didn't necessarily mean that everyone was going to come off with and buy something because, you know, the GM, he put things in there that were interesting. They had fairly broad interest. You know, maybe I had to make the decision. I wanted to buy three or four things. I only had the means to buy one, maybe two if I was lucky. So it was always a downslug for me. But some of the other characters, maybe they either didn't have the money or they just didn't really want anything. So
that's that sort of selective and consistent in-character rarity is how I'm handling Ardmir, my Magocracy game. There are tons of magic items because the Wizards Rule Society, they get all the resources they want, but they're all stockpiled and employed by the various schools and houses. And if you don't have good political ties with the evokers, you're going to have a tough time getting a fireball wand, say. And it's even tougher to get magic weapons and armor and stuff for the muggle classes because who the hell cares? Why would you make a +2 sword when you could make a staff that has 50 casts of magic missile in it to the wizards who are the only ones who can make the magic items? That's how it's done.
One of the other approaches we tossed out while discussing this is handling a lot of it offline. Hmm. That if they don't need it right this second, if this is not a down game, if this is not a, okay, I know we're going to the dungeon, I really need some more lantern oil. If this is something that can wait, you really encourage your players, hey, just email me. Maybe we can even RP a little bit in email. You know what? I'm a big believer in that.
Yeah.
Big believer. I put on my wizard robe and hat.
I know Tat's going to take me a task on this.
Oh, yeah.
During Star Wars.
It's already creepy enough between you guys and Battletech.
It can only get better.
If only Chris were here.
Mm-hmm. No, he's
snail mail role play.
But you know what? One of the great things to keep a role playing game
blue balls.
Yeah.
Going is to RP a little bit offline through emails, through conversations, sort of keep thinking in character, even if it's not real deep. Get the people in your group, say, look, I don't want to sit here and stop the game while five people work from one DMG to shop for magic items. Fine, we're playing whatever high fantasy game. Ye old magic mart and the weapons shop and all that stuff makes sense in this setting.
And there is a unicorn proprietor who barfs out rainbows as you enter.
And that's fine in your setting.
Ugh.
Email me.
There are rules in this Dungeon Master's Guide for a Blink Dog player character.
Yeah,
if a unicorn can be a shopkeeper, well, I say a Blink Dog can be the mayor.
John, I want you to promise me something.
What?
Because no one has ever let me play this. Will you run a game someday where I can play a Waymick?
Sure.
Okay, excellent.
I don't know how he's going to fit. You probably won't like him, but you can be him.
Hey, I got off with a Null. I can.
Let you play a Null in Blood Moons. If you recall, you asked to play Null in the Goblin Campaign. Yes, you did.
I thought my first...
Right off the bat, I said, nope, there's just no way that he can cohere within the society. It was a hard decision for me because I knew you really, really wanted to play that.
Oh, that's fine.
That was pre-Gnarl.
Yeah, it was pre-Gnarl, and then that came along a chance.
We should have a short, super high fantasy, freak show, whacked out D&D game because I really want to play a troll.
That's what I ran. That's the one thing I did. I ran a high fantasy campaign.
After this Battletech campaign, we're going to make Pat run... Not like a one-shotter, but like a five or ten-shotter. Yeah. We are just going to play this total zoo.
Yeah, like an ECL 8 D&D campaign where the maximum character level you can start out with is like 2 or 3. So you have to play something from the nutso list. That'd be amazing.
I really enjoyed playing my evil troll character. The one that you guys ran into, I think he...
Oh, that was disfiguring himself?
Yeah, the one that...
he felt his eyes interfered with his spirit vision or whatever.
Yeah, he'd pluck his eyes out every once in a while because they interfere with his spirit vision, and I think he did some augury for you, and he cut off his finger as part of one of the regents and stuff, and the eyes always grew back, and everything always grew back.
All right, gentlemen, here are the races in the 3.0 DMG that are class level 4 above. These are your options for Pat's campaign. Centaur, we'll give Wemic to that because it's a lion centaur.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Ogre, Minotaur, Pixie, Werebear.
I see a troll in armor.
Satyr with pipes. I don't know why that notation is there, but Satyr with pipes.
This troll, is the non-pipes. There we go.
Blink troll. Dog, Ogre Mage, Unicorn, and Hill Giant.
Hill Giant.
None of these are speaking to me except Blink Dog, and I don't think I'm going to make that work. So I'm going to get up the Monster Spaniel. I will have a character by the time this episode... What are we at, 40 minutes? Oh, yeah, I got years. 20 minutes. I've written term papers in 20 minutes.
Oh, I love it.
So I think shopping, as with a lot of the other stuff in a bridge game, really comes down to just figuring out what your group wants and what makes sense within your setting.
Well, and that's what I was saying at the beginning, too, because there's such a range. There's no, like, one good piece of advice other than not even so much know the group, but kind of know the situation. Sometimes if somebody just wants to buy a candle, I'm almost of the opinion, I'm not running your character, I'm not tracking your money as the game master, and I really don't give two and a half if you have a candle or not. Just write it down. You know, we're role playing here. Don't bother me with the petty bullshit. But on the other hand, you can do the I want to buy a candle, and you can make that something really cool.
You could.
And you can make that into a really interesting situation.
Let me also cut a third possibility, because I agree with you on both accounts. You can make it a game distraction. You can also make a deep role playing opportunity. But the third thing that I've had to deal with as a GM is,
John, you always flip through the dragons.
Internal consistency.
I've already made my character. I'm going to be a very young brass dragon who doesn't even want to be a dragon.
So you will have brass balls?
I will have brass balls. But the brass dragons are the ones that are always very talkative and will polymorph and, like, just talk to people for hours on end. Or gas cloud them, knock them out, bury them up to their head in sand so they can talk to them more without leaving. this will be my character concept. I don't know if I have polymorph at this level of development. I might take a couple levels of sorcerer to at least get, like, alter person. But, wow. Yeah, this is my freak
show. You
know
what we ought to do? We ought to just pick our race and make the people on the forums make the characters for us, play this abomination out, and do reports back on how it goes.
Dude, I'm willing to mic this one up and make it the LP. They've been waiting for it for years.
You just described the wet dream of, I'm going to say, 66% of the forum listeners there, Dan.
No, I know.
Just now, as they're listening to this, they are a quivering mass.
So the third issue.
I'm taking levels of bard.
That I wanted.
I'm going to show Wayne how it's done.
Wayne is be a dragon now.
Is internal consistency. I've run several games.
Like a podcast about one topic.
Where characters pull stuff out of their ass that is just way too convenient. Don't get me wrong. It's mundane items. But it just so happens that the only thing that could possibly get you out of this situation is a paperclip.
I've always said
that. And what do you know? Somebody just so happens to have one. And that's a little bit of exaggeration.
I've always said that in a modern to futuristic setting, you could rule the world if you had a clipboard.
I agree with you completely. And that's the one reason that I make people keep equipment lists and tell me what they have is because of the fact that, you know, look, if you say, I want to buy a flashlight, no biggie. Knock off a dollar and put it on your character sheet. But the reason I want it there is because it could be a plot point. You guys fall into a dark pit, none of you have flashlights. If you suddenly pull a flashlight out of your ass, my question is going to be, you just got here from picking up snow cones. Why do you have a flashlight on you?
I have a flashlight in my pocket right now.
Once again.
And so do you.
I'm not saying it's implausible. Yeah. I'm just saying that I want to have some understanding of where this came from, because that's a minor one. But what if it's something more major? What if it's, I don't know, M. Night Shyamalan is running a game for us, and we have aliens invading a planet that's high humidity and over 70% water, and they can't take water. Whether you have bottled water on you or not, it's now suddenly a major plot point.
You're also sort of getting into the territory, too, where you get going that direction, you also get into the sticky wicket that I have always hated of encumbrance. Because when you start talking about keeping
equipment
lists, I only do encumbrance when
how far do you really go? Because
real bad.
I only go to encumbrance as a fallback when the player is out of his damn mind.
Yeah, me too.
I was playing a BattleTech game where Mike had a character where he just kept pulling crap out of his butt, and I'm like, "What the hell do you have on your character sheet?" He showed it to me. Now, mind you, I'm just going to give you two portions of his equipment list. Two portions. This is what was on him at any given moment. Six rifles
And, oh, yeah, this is the one I asked him if he had a trailer hitch on his ass.
And 10, what in Battletech are called maxi grenades. To put these in perspective.
Those get pretty bloody.
I know, I was waiting for
about
that joke.
Basically, they're about the size of a watermelon.
Yeah.
With a handle on it.
These are, like, huge. Yeah. Like, they're all but satchel charges. He had 10 of them. And 6 rifles.
Hey, he could afford it.
He had a battle mech repair kit, which is described as being something on a push cart.
Mm-hmm.
And it just... Thank you, John.
That's awesome.
You're welcome.
I'm just going with the flow.
So, have you ever played Stalker, Shadow over Chernobyl?
No.
I'm playing that right now. Actually, I finished that, and I'm playing Clear Sky, and I've got Call of Pripyat next, and they have an encumbrance system. Everything's in metric, and we have these things called booter calls, which are Skype. The Fear the Boot community gets on Skype, and we just kind of jump on this big chat room together. There's probably about 10, 15 of us, whatever. And
I want to do that.
Yeah, why don't you?
I didn't know they existed.
I didn't either. And I'm learning.
What is this?
I get on this podcast to learn things about Fear the Boot.
You know,
that's true.
On our forums, we have a forum thread called Booter Call. You might want to check that out
because it's close. It sounds like it's close to something I'd enjoy.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm on this Booter Call and I'm talking about this game and I'm actually what I'm doing is explaining how Stalker Shadow over Chernobyl is turning me into a racist. Because it's Russian, right? Everybody's in Russia. And it's a brutal game.
Right.
I mean, it is unforgiving.
So you hate Ukrainians.
Oh, my God, do I? It's just like... I
hate Russians from EVE Online.
Like, oh, my God. It's like they all speak Russian. They're all wearing track suits. And they're all cutting me in half with double-barrel shotguns. And it's like we'll be talking about role-playing. And I'll be like, God damn Russians! You Russians! And then it's, you know, we can't go on. But I was talking about this.
I think Call of Chernobyl's in Ukraine.
Ukraine, yeah.
So you really are racist.
I probably am.
Okay.
I was talking to him about the guns in the game are very accurate. They took a lot, you know, the physics are accurate, the guns are accurate, all this sort of stuff. And then I was separately talking about how there's an encumbrance system and everything is in metric. And I'm like, I don't know the metric system and blah, blah, blah. And I don't know how much this actually is.
Quick and dirty. This is not exactly right. A kilogram is roughly 2 pounds.
Yeah.
So if you just want to quick and dirty, multiply the kilograms by 2, you have pounds.
Yeah.
If you don't want to be so quick and dirty, 2.2 pounds. But, you know.
Okay. So anyway, I was like.
Just some cock.
Yeah.
Go on.
So anyway.
Finish your yoke.
I'm trying to. I was shooting this gun and we're talking about the encumbered system. I'm like, man, this is a really accurate game. How deep does this game get? I'm like, oh, my God.
Are
they weighing each individual bullet?
That would really ruffle my feathers.
So I have the gun, and my gun has a weight, right? And it's like I take the scope off of it.
Which recoups a little weight.
And the weight goes down on it. And then I lift the gun up, and I'm like, pop! And I fire the gun, and I check the gun's weight. The gun's weight has gone down the weight of one bullet. Their encumbrance system in Stalker is down to the bullet. Every individual thing has
weight.
That's
pretty bird-brained.
Yeah.
The closest I can think of to that was Fallout. I think some of the earlier ones, like Fallout 1 and 2, they counted weight on everything. Everything may have included ammo. I don't remember. I know in Fallout 3, ammo did not have weight.
Thank God.
In New Vegas, it did in survival mode.
Oh, really?
But in 1 and 2, I can't remember whether it did or not. I want to say it did. I don't recall.
I don't remember.
When you have a really punishing encumbrance system, I cry foul.
I just don't want to henpeck players with that. It's just too much to keep track of. Because, hell, I remember in, like, D&D 2nd Edition, where you had to keep track of not just how much something weighed. You had to explain where it was.
Yep.
It was in this pouch. It was in this backpack. Yeah. And it got really...
I just wonder which came first, the encumbrance or the abuse of the system. Yeah.
In the backroom mechanics of Dragon Realms, my old mud, every single item has a compressibility factor. So not only is there the cubic volume of the containers you can put it in, like... A hat will scrunch up and take less space
in a backpack,
but a sword or shield won't.
Wow.
So, like, that is truly the nth dimension of nuts.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, that's the nth dimension.
There's a real attribute. I mean, I can fold my coat. I can't fold my...
You know what? Here's
to
the
me,
thing.
Computer.
Just how damn realistic do you want the
game? Yeah, I mean, I don't want to think
and
that
I'll
much.
Go back design-wise, too. You have to understand the purpose of a game. And by a game, I don't mean all games. I mean that game. In Skies of Glass, we get fairly detailed with things like injury, infection, whether it's healing or getting worse, whether it's bleeding out. Why? It's a survival game. In Apocryphos, I don't deal with it. It's really only one step more complex than D&D hit points. Why? It's high tech. It's futuristic. That's not the issue you're dealing with. The game is about something else. If you are playing a game that for some reason, it is really about your ability to manage the limited resource of carrying capacity. Yeah. This is a game.
Well, it's like a video game, survival horror. You play something like Doom or Duke Nukem.
It's like,
yeah, you want unlimited ammo and just a bullet fest. But if you're playing something that is a survival horror, that's part of the genre.
Elder Scrolls, Fallout, they're all like that. What you carry with you, you have to pick things that are A, maximum usefulness, and or B, maximum resale. Yeah.
Well, like in,
because you can't pick up every broom or
I still think it's dumb that you can have a game set in a police station wherein you cannot find a box of 9mm bullets to save your life. But that is part of the genre.
Yeah. Well, and that's like in Stalker, too. It's just like you're in the middle of a firefight, and the condition of your gun is going down, and you're running out of, well, you have like 3 bullets left. Your weight is great because you burn through all your bullets, but the gun is breaking down and it's just like, you really like this gun. And then you're just like, I guess I got to pick up the AK off the guy I just killed because he's got some bullets and he's got a gun and I got to make do.
Today was a good day.
I did not have to use my AK.
So as we wrap this show up, the more I think about this, the more I like it. That with this Freak Show Pat game, we get the forums to design our characters for us. But Chad, do you think that's going to work for your character?
No. Why not? It's not going to work for my character because, as I mentioned, the character that I wanted to play
is an NPC from a game that already occurred.
A game that already occurred. And that's fine. That's fine. You know, I could play that or just not take part in the forum thing or whatever. But it still further won't work because, I mean, the type of game that you guys are talking about, I'm playing a bronze dragon who likes to talk to people, and so I sleep them and bury them at the head, up to the head in the sand, and I talk to them more, and it's very...
Well, I also go on adventures because I'm curious.
Oh, yeah, no, that's great. That's not a criticism. That's great in the genre. The thing is that my troll that I played is very disturbing. He's incredible, like black-hearted, unremorseful evil.
That's an odd couple comedy waiting to happen.
Like
when John buries you up to your neck and makes you talk about evil things.
Disturbing things.
Yeah. And
I will find your pugnaciousness and lack of courtesy rude, and I will accuse you of trolling.
So, no, that's just what I'm saying, is that I don't think my character, he's too dark. He's grimdark.
Okay, well, I don't think this is going to be grimdark.
Yeah.
I don't know what Dan the Weemick is going to come down to, but he's probably going to be like the face-palm lion.
I can't imagine a Weemick being grimdark, so.
Well, and
sounds like a challenge.
Supposedly they were chaotic neutral or chaotic evil.
I'm not sure, though. Grimdark freak show game?
Grimdark freak shows? I mean, we could. I could just turn around and be a white dragon. They're basically animals.
Mm-hmm.
Or a red.
I see these gears turning in your head. Well, you've got that look of,
I know,
this isn't what I intended.
We're asking each other as players, but that's the wrong thing to ask.
Well,
Pat, what are we going for with the psycho
game? I'm looking at Dan's face, and Dan's expression is, it's twofold. Let me see if I interpreted this right. One is, this isn't the direction we were going. This isn't the direction that I wanted to go. I've got some really good ideas that I could go with.
So how do I reconcile this with what Pat wants, with what the forum comes up with?
Well, first of all, what Pat wants right now is, at this point, still 4.5 margaritas deep, so it doesn't really matter.
Pat, let me tell you about my Wednesday Skype game. The last time I would have blown zero running that was never.
Well, we'll continue to stew on this for a little while longer while I... think about this nugget. But in the meantime, as always, take a look at the show notes if you're looking for a link to anything we mentioned along the way. I did not expect shopping to turn into the entire episode, but hey, we've got content for our next recording.
There you go.
Well, actually, no, we don't, for the recording after that, because the next recording is going to be Beth and possibly Carla and possibly Miranda.
Trouble.
So
the chick roundup.
With John and Dan there to antagonize. So,
and also put a link to the forums post about the booter call.
I'll have to look that up. Yes, I'll put a link to the booter call. So,
and we will see you in a galaxy far, far away very soon.
Yes, so thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
See ya.
Bye.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2011. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.